Welcome to MHM Podcast Network on MovieHouseMemories.com. Podcast for pod people. Our feature presentation begins now.
To Movie House Concessions on the MHM Podcast Network, where each episode we pull a random film from the display case to see if it tastes as fresh as the day it was released. I'm Chris.
And I'm Bobby.
And for this episode, Bobby is going to sing.
I'm going to sing.
As we review 1975's epic Monty Python and the Holy Grail, directed by the Terrys, Terry Gilliam, and Terry Jones. Bobby likes the Terry better than the other Terry, oddly.
I like Gilliam. He did the Robin Williams.
Kingfisher. We're on the ball.
Yes, we are.
Terry Gilliam, he does a lot of great films. And this one stars the deceased Graham Chapman, the living John Cleese.
Kind of.
I think he's still good. Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin. And a lot of knights who say knee. Or something like that. Mm. But before we begin, I'm going to spoil the shit out of this film per Bobby's request.
Yes. Just don't tell anybody about the Black Knight at the bridge.
Are we going to do wacky credits? With the llama and sack him.
Sure. You got to put, got to do the sound effects to go with it. Yeah.
Wick.
Mm-hmm. Get the yeehaw. The llamas. Did you read all the credits?
Many times. It's one of the best parts. Other than Cannonball Run's ending with the bloopers and the bleeds. Mm-hmm. This is the only other credits that I probably know by heart.
Really? Which is funny because, spoiler alert, there are no credits at the end of the movie.
Well, opening credits.
Yes.
Not too many films will people, or at least will I, pay attention to opening credits, but.
Yeah.
You know, Monty Python being absurd, and there you go.
Well, it was so funny because I put on the DVD and I'm watching it at the very beginning, and I've watched this multiple times, but I tend to forget certain things about credits for some reason. And Icelandic, Norwegian? What was it that was at the bottom? It had subtitles going, and I'm like, what is that? Why is that? and then the subtitles kicked in. It was just,
I forget what the language was.
Wasn't it Norwegian something along?
It was something European.
Yeah, it was really funny. It was like, then he starts talking about the llamas, and that was terrific.
So after an epic opening credit scene with much expense and colors and variety.
And sacking.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail will begin in the 10th century AD, where Arthur, King of the Britons, and by default, the head of the Church of England, trods through the shires of his land with his humble patsy.
And his coconuts.
And that reminds me, as we're recording this, Halloween was just about a week ago, and I saw some husband-wife. The wife was patsy with the coconuts. Awesome. It was a great, great costume. She had a lovely bunch of coconuts.
Lovely set of coconuts. Yeah.
Let's see. So Patsy was by his side to recruit the famous Knights of the Round Table. He eventually enlists Sir Belvedere the Wise, Sir Lancelot the Brave, Sir Galahad the Pure, Sir Robin the not so quite brave as Sir Lancelot, and Bobby the aptly named Sir Knot appearing in this film. My God, I hope he's in the sequel.
Now he got launched into the sea of, or the abyss.
On the Trojan rabbit?
Yes.
Once assembled, God himself appears. So they've got that going for him, which is nice.
Voiced by Mr. Graham Chapman himself.
And that voice sends out our brave heroes on a quest to find the Holy Grail, as the Church of England is in sore need of some idols to worship. And really, who isn't ever in sore need for that?
So they build their own rabbit.
Right. Worshipping false. I don't know. Yes. They first come across the French castle of Guy de Lombard, and being good, the good Roman Catholics they are, they already have a grail.
Yes.
It's very nice.
That they are not going to show you.
After much taunting and farting in their general direction, Arthur's band of merry Knigets are repelled. They decide to split up and seek the grail. It's always best to split up in these situations, don't you think, Bobby?
Yeah, especially when you're Sir Gawain. Was it Gawain? Galahad. Where Galahad ended up at.
I bet you're gay. No, I'm not.
No, he ended up meeting the... He was at the castle with the all of the nuns.
Anthrax.
Suddenly,
we cut to the present day, where a historian narrates the story for us. But his throat is suddenly slashed by an unknown knight riding by on horseback. Say that 10 times fast, Bobby.
Well, that knight also was, he's the reason why there was some false arrests later on in the film.
Those damn British cops.
Yeah, they didn't know who it was.
They didn't care. Arrest no. First, ask questions later.
Yes. No fingerprints on a blade.
Yeah. Oddly, because of what Bobby just said, it's not so surprising that the modern day police are called in to find this Anglo-Saxon assassin. I'm pretty sure that's what he was. Or he had just come from the Renaissance Festival. I'm not sure what he was.
I think he was the Black Knight that got his arms chopped off and they had no fingerprints to go off. Mm.
Those flesh wounds, they heal easily.
Yes.
So now we cut back to hear the tale of brave Sir Robin. And his bravery is immediately tested when he meets the three-headed Goliath who wants to kill him. Instead of bravely standing up to the giant in the name of the Knights of the Round Table, he cowers and downplays his importance. As the three heads argue over hygiene, and really in those close quarters, why wouldn't you in that day and age? Robin turns his tail and flees.
Which is interesting because they seem somewhat immobile.
They weren't really move very a whole fast, lot.
No. Made his escape easy.
I wonder whose hand would have been used for the sword.
I think it would have been Graham Chapman's. He was the one in the middle.
But he usually has a drink in his hands, so I don't know.
They probably had to tie his hands behind him so he wouldn't drink to do the part.
So after that test has failed, we go to the next one of Sir Galahad the Pure.
The not so pure, as it turns out, once he got into Castle Anthrax.
Well, let me tell you something. If I was in his position, I would not be the pure either.
He didn't get into any position.
No, because of the brave.
Sir he was rescued.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like he needed it. What a cock block.
Stupid Lancelot.
On a rainy afternoon, Galahad is lured to Castle Anthrax by a false idol that looks like the Grail. I forgot it was kind of Grail shaped. Bad zoot. Once inside, Galahad's purity is tested when he finds the castle is filled with sexually frustrated girls from, what was their age? 18 to 22?
No, it was 16 to 19 and a half.
Well, I guess that just became illegal for us, Bobby.
And it definitely didn't deserve the PG rating that it got.
Well, those outfits were a little see-through and wet.
Kind of.
Galahad succumbs to their delights. Surprise, surprise. Can't blame him. But he's rescued at the last second by the brave, Bobby.
Sir Idiot Lancelot.
The cock block.
Yes.
He rescues him from a very perilous situation. Let me have a little bit of peril.
I think he wanted the peril.
I don't blame him.
He wanted a pair of perils.
Well, when you're going across the British countryside for however long they were, you got to have a little bit of peril. Scene 24 takes us to meet a crazy old man who tells Arthur and Sir Belvedere of an enchanter and the Bridge of Death. The old man then disappears, and the two Kniggets find themselves in a mysterious forest. After much clumping around, they come across the knights who say, "Knee," and they demand Arthur bring them a shrubbery to appease them, or they will be killed.
I saw some shrubbery in Castle Anthrax while they were taking their shower. Mm. Would that have sufficed?
It would have worked for me. Mm. Shrubbery's a shrubbery.
That's right.
I'm no botanist, but...
Well, it's neatly trimmed.
75? It might have been...
Maybe not so.
Yeah, might have been a minor forest. This is the little hippie days au naturel. Still not saying no. Where the hell did I leave off? Arthur agrees to bring them a shrubbery, but he refuses to bring another one once the knights who say need change their name. I can't pronounce the new name.
Boing. Neither could they.
Yeah. Nee. Meanwhile, we got our first meanwhile, Bobby. Over at Swamp Castle, Sir Lancelot finds a note tied to an arrow when it pierces Sweet Concord's chest. I'm getting better.
Just lay there.
He mistakenly thinks the note is referring to a lady in distress.
That technically is. He was accurate.
I think the jury's still out, yes. Who is being told they're being held against their will and is being forced to marry someone whom she does not love.
He.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah. To marry someone whom he does not love.
I don't think he or she loves her.
I don't think he loved hers regardless.
No.
He would not have been tempted at Castle Anthrax. That's all we're saying. Sir Lancelot's bravery is successfully tested as he storms the castle and kills everybody.
Pretty much everybody.
The bride's father, mother.
I think he killed him three times. Yeah. I'm not sure. there was a lot of death on top of death. And then had to do it backwards, killing the same people more than once.
It was in his idiom.
Well, if you look at the credits, you're noticing that they're killing the same people 20 times anyway. So they probably just, for editing purposes, it was easier just to continue to kill people.
Well, when he runs up to the castle, which is one of my favorite running up to it, they just cut
7 or 8 times.
Yeah. And the guy's eating his apple or whatever.
Right.
Stabs one. Hey.
Yeah. Hey, watching him run right by.
Effing fantastic. So Lancelot saves that effeminate man. He flees in an idiom worthy of his bravery via a push on the rope to swing across the bleeding masses and masses of people below him. No singing occurred.
No, the singing had already occurred.
Eventually, the knights regroup. Yay. And they journey together to an enchanter named Tim.
Yes.
That might have been
a great enchanter.
I think John Cleese might have forgot the name or his line or something and came up with that. I could be wrong.
That would be fitting, wouldn't it?
He leads them to a cave that will reveal the Grail's location, but before they are able to enter, they must first slay a rabbit.
Yes. Before they get to the animated death monster, right? Wasn't the rabbit
with fangs and whatever?
The rabbit was the frontal assault.
Yeah. The rabbit repels them.
Mm-hmm.
Kills everything until
Arthur decapitates one guy, right?
Yeah. Blood everywhere. It was like Watership Down level of rabbit blood. That's how much blood was in this thing. But Arthur uses the holy hand grenade of Antioch to blow that fuzzy bunny sky high. Once inside, they are attacked again. This second attack is Bobby's Black Beast of Arg.
That was drawn with such precision. Well, you got- so as to give the animator such so much of his mind and body that when the time came for him to chomp down on some Kniggets, he croaked.
Fatal cardiac arrest. Mm. What are the odds?
Especially on camera. I mean, that was amazing, that the timing they had.
On cue.
Yeah.
Talk about method actor.
Wow.
All Arthur has to do now is cross that bridge of death by answering three simple questions from the bridge keeper.
I can do that.
Incidentally, he's the same crazy old guy as in scene 24. I don't know if you noticed, Bobby, but
No.
Yeah. Go figure. You know, if they don't answer those questions right, they're going to be tossed into the gorge of eternal peril. It's very perilous. I don't know if it's as perilous as Castle Anthrax. That's some high quality peril there, though.
I don't know if it was the same. Was it the same place that was in the labyrinth? If you fell in, you'd smell bad for the rest of eternity.
What was that? The pit of eternal stench? What was it?
Yes, that's it.
And those puppets did step into it. I don't care. Jim Henson's little creatures were not very flexible. They stepped into that shit.
Well, and the inside of those puppet costumes had to smell about like that. So that's where they got the idea.
All right. The two Kniggets who failed their test, they in their mini quest, Sir Robin and Sir Galahad, they're tossed into the gorge for not knowing the gatekeeper's questions. Sir Lancelot, Sir Belvedere, and King Arthur, they easily pass. But Sir Lancelot, he's quickly arrested on the other side of the bridge by the modern day police. How the fuck does that work?
Time travel. Right. This was a very expensive film.
Yeah.
Lots of special effects.
That leaves Arthur and Sir Belvedere to journey to the final castle to retrieve the Holy Grail. Unfortunately for our heroes, that castle is occupied by our same French assholes from the beginning of the film, and they begin to taunt Arthur once again.
And throw out more cows.
Arthur retreats to get a large army of men to take the castle by force.
But and women. Let's be fair.
Were there some ladies there? I don't remember.
Well, the Castle Anthrax ladies had to have been there somewhere.
Oh.
They reused the cast a lot.
They were probably giving first aid, even if it wasn't needed.
Yes.
Nothing wrong with that.
No.
And before they can attack, the modern day police arrive and they arrest everybody. Doesn't matter. There only one person killed the historian,
right.
but they arrest a large army of people.
There were a lot of swords that were on that set, so they had to make sure they got the right one.
Mm-hmm. And also Arthur and Sir Belvedere are arrested, ending the film for a fair cop. The end.
I sat there for the next 5 minutes watching black, listening to the mariachi music, waiting for credits to show up, thinking there was something else.
Wick? Yeah, I think it was an after credit scene for the next
Avengers movie. Yep. Yeah.
Bobby, did you by any chance do numbers for this exquisite?
Oh, I film? Did. Oh, it was awesome.
Can you wait. Say it in the form of a llama?
I'm going to die on cue. I have a release date in the UK of May 25th, 1975. The budget was £229,575, which was out about $500,000 US, roughly.
And every single dollar was on that screen.
Boy, isn't that the truth? They had to use so many people so many times, so they got paid triple, five plus five, right? The domestic numbers are 1 million 827,696, international numbers of 113,210, for a worldwide total of 1,940,906. And I will give a caveat, this may be the re-release of this. I didn't have something that would tell me the difference between those numbers from 1975, or they were the re-release in 2001, which was released. It was released again in the theaters. Surprisingly, and I know you're surprised, Chris, no Academy Award nominations for this. So no special effects, nothing. It was nominated for several 1975 Hugos. However, it was only nominated. I don't have record of any Hugos being won by this fabulous film. The Hollywood Reporter has it down as Hollywood's 100 favorite films, and it is number 68 on that list. And IMDb's top rated movies has it down as the number 94 movie on IMDb of all time, as far as I can tell. Rotten Tomatoes has it down as a 98% tomato meter and a 95% audience score. And it is considered by many to be the best Monty Python film of all of their stuff, including their TV show. So those are the numbers that I have that I could find. And I'm sure they're wrong.
You know, this was one that we've already reviewed for Movie House Memories. It's in my top 100. And I wanted to review it because we had to take that one off the air for various reasons. But
did you sack the person that gave you the,
we sacked the person who put the video up on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
But this actually is not my favorite of the Monty Python films, but I think out of all of the films of my generation, this and Caddyshack are probably the two most quotable for all of my friends that I know. I mean, and I would be interested to know if anybody, if there's any sort of list as to most quotable films, because I would have to imagine that this is in the top five, everything from Knights to Say Who Say Knee to The Black Knight. 'Tis but a scratch, you know, just everything in this film is so utterly quotable, even if you haven't seen the film.
Yes. Well, my wife, who loathes this film, by the way, and I love it.
Does she like Monty Python?
No. And okay. But I had shown this to my son when he was probably 8 years old, and I just wanted him to see the Black Knight scene because I just thought it was so funny. And he ended up watching the whole film with me when he was eight. And to this day, he still remembers that Black Knight, because I was watching it with my wife, and she just took a picture of the Black Knight on screen that we were watching, and she texted it to him and said, guess what we're watching tonight? He goes, greatest scene of all time. He's 24 years old now. So yeah. It has a lasting memory for sure.
Yeah, it didn't win the awards, but man, I tell you, it's got a cult following.
That scene alone is truly a classic. Even if you hate comedy like this, as dumb as it is, that was classic.
And it's a great parody of King Arthur as well.
Oh yes. Side by side with Excalibur. I would watch this anytime.
You know, when he's talking to Dennis, the peasant, I didn't vote for him.
Right.
You know,
this is oppression.
Yeah.
Exactly. Help
see the oppression inherent in the system. Yeah. It's just such a sharp comedy. And even though Life of Brian is probably a top five film of all time for me, I put it up there with Empire Strikes Back, any Indiana Jones, you know, it's wow. Sometimes it could be number one, depending on my mood.
This one or Life of Brian?
Life of Brian. Okay. This one is not as high, but this one is utterly more quotable than Life of Brian, as much as I enjoy Life of Brian. There's just something about the silliness of this film that I think resonates with a lot of people.
It does. And I think that this, the story is so familiar because, and I think that was what was so great about it, is the lampooning that they were doing of the horses with the coconuts and all of the special effects and the giving the French the silly accents. And it was all meant as to be, it wasn't meant to hurt people's feelings. It was just meant to be fun. And I think that's that they came across really well. I mean, the bunny, you know, who has a killer bunny in their film in the middle of the, you know, because he comes walking out there like that. It's just a bunny. And then he rips his head off. And then, you know, hey, you know, answer these three questions. I can do that. Or, you know, what did he say? He says, that's easy. And he walks out there. And
in his very arrogant manner.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they even lambasted the absurdity in logic as to how to determine who's a witch, you know, making fun of the times. Right. And I even know people who will say that if somebody mentions a witch, like on Reddit or something, you can almost guarantee somewhere in the comments, somebody's going to say, does she float on water? Yeah. You know, just, this is immensely quotable film.
Mm-hmm.
But some people absolutely hate it, which makes me laugh. Chad doesn't absolutely hate it, but he doesn't like it well enough to even review it with us tonight.
Well, to be completely fair, I'm not a big Life of Brian fan either. So I know that Monty Python is a taste film or a taste group. Just like SNL is a taste group, and people have their favorites, but Monty Python, you got to give them credit for when they came out, they were cutting edge at the time. So I give them a lot of credit. I just don't necessarily have to love the film.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes they're British humor for
Americans. Yeah.
You know, sometimes it can be like, this is the dumbest thing ever. I say this a lot about, do you ever see the TV show Absolutely Fabulous?
Yes, I'd have.
You know, back, I don't know, what was it, late 90s? It was like a big hit on Comedy Central for some reason. And I watched, I don't know, maybe 10 episodes. I'm like, what are people talking about? This is the dumbest show I have ever seen. And then I just saw one episode of theirs and it all clicked for me. And so then after that, you know, everything in Absolutely Fabulous made sense. I think Monty Python is very much like that as well.
I think a lot of the Python actors that went on to many other things, I think they brought a lot of their Python-esque personalities into it. And it does depend on what their audience is, because I'm the same way with Fawlty Towers with John Cleese, which came in after this. And that one, the first episode or two, I was just like, I get some of the humor, but, and I love British humor, and it just didn't really click until I hit I can't remember which episode, but that's exactly right. It clicked and went, oh, I love it. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on your audience. And to be completely fair, maybe I'm thicker than most English people, so I don't necessarily get their humor as easily as they would. But you know, this was funny. Monty Python's Holy Grail was very funny to me, but I've also seen it many times.
That's one of the things about it. It's got a lot of replay value.
Well, and the absurdity, like you said, is that, you know, they're talking to this narrator from 1977, 76?
He would have been 75 doing a typical English historian. Yeah,
and the next thing you know is, you know, the police are called into it, and that becomes a running joke through the story. And, you know, when you have a limited budget and you're just running around to the countryside and, you know, with coconuts, you know, you don't have a livestock budget. You don't have a gun budget. You know, no special effects budget. It's really easy to make these kinds of films, and but it's hard to have the humor that actually hits and makes you laugh out loud. But they did a really good job of that with this.
And then their special effects budget, they use it on stupid stuff like Tim blowing up random things and they all clap.
Right. Right.
Golf clap.
Right. Yep.
Just going completely absurd.
Or basically they run out of money, so they kill off the animator.
Let's talk about the actors. Graham Chapman, King Arthur. And out of all the Pythons, I can't imagine any of them being able to play King Arthur.
Oh, no.
Other than Graham Chapman. I don't know what it is about Graham, but he's kind of got this regal authority about him in this film. I can't imagine John Cleese or any of them pulling off that role.
Nope. He, like you said, I think, yeah, there's nobody that could do that. John Cleese would have been the closest, and he would have been too over the top with it.
I feel John Cleese would be too silly.
Yep, exactly. No, Graham Chapman was awesome. I thought he was terrific. And it was his delivery, because he had almost like he had tightened his mouth as he was speaking, and it made or kind of almost a whistle in how he was speaking. It was kind of a funny delivery, and it was perfect. King of the Britons.
No lisp like when he says biggest dickus in Life of Brian, but John Cleese, who played Sir Lancelot, but I really think the Black Knight's what he's remembered most for in this film.
Yeah. Well, it totally right. Because that was his character was basically kill and stand there and take abuse and then just threaten. And then just, you know, and then it became farce after that. So it was just, that was his best character of the whole bunch for sure. Tim the Enchanter was actually pretty funny. And I think that was, like you said, if that was truly a flub, it was a perfect, that was almost inspired flub to give him the name Tim.
Terry Gilliam, who's usually the animator. Hmm? He was Patsy, Arthur's servant.
Honestly, I didn't recognize him.
No?
No, because I always see, you know, you hear of a Terry Gilliam film, but I don't necessarily see him very often. So he was more of a, so I wasn't as in on him.
I saw a lot of Time Bandits in this film, mm-hmm. or maybe saw a lot of Holy Grail in Time Bandits, since Time Bandits was after this. But
well, definitely the costuming for sure was mm-hmm. influenced Time Bandits. Yep.
Eric Idle as the,
love him.
As the yes. not so quite brave as Sir Lancelot, Sir Robin.
That's promptly
turned his tail and fled.
Yes. I love Eric Idle in everything, honestly, everything. So he's a home run for me. Just throw him in something and I'll laugh.
Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah. Nuns on the Run. Yep.
But what amuses me is that, you know, all these guys are talented. They probably could have done a reasonable job in any of these roles, but it seems like what they selected, I can't imagine the other Pythons in that role, you know,
right.
Terry Jones as Sir Belvedere, the Wise. Who right. are you? Well, that even, knows even such...
Eric Idle is as Concord.
Yeah. Sweet Concord.
Yeah. And what I did like is how they overlapped each storyline. They actually played characters and never, it wasn't like, I mean, very rarely did Graham Chapman actually, you know, it was King Arthur speaking to the voice of God. That was the one scene where he's sharing the screen together. The rest of the scenes, they chose a spot in the film and okay, you know, here's the six of you guys, pick somebody and let's play the role. They leave and then they come back and here's six more roles. Who's what? And like you said, they fit them so well that you can't see any of the other guys playing that character.
And so well. You don't really get confused with them in the film. Like Graham Chapman, you know, he is the main character, but he's also the hiccuping guard.
Right. Yeah. Or the middle head.
Yeah.
I mean, you knew that was the guys, but yeah, that was the whole thing. You take it for what it is, which is it's just funny.
Now, were you puzzled by the ending? I don't know if I brought this up when we reviewed it on Movie House Memories, but the ending is, depending on how familiar you are with Monty Python, the TV show, it could be a complete letdown or it can be hysterical. I'm just curious as to what you think.
Well, it has been a few years since I've seen the film. And honestly, I was, when the music started and it went to black screen, I honestly was sitting there waiting. And, you know, they're doing whatever was the circus music. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, where's the credits? You know, where's the action? Where's anything? And I just kept going and I'm like, and I just grabbed my fast forward button, just started fast forwarding and the movie ended. I mean, the DVD just stopped. I'm like, did I just miss something? You know, what happened? So I was not, even though I've seen this multiple times, I completely forgot that that was the ending. Yeah.
Because the running joke on the TV show is that they never knew how to end a skit.
Yeah.
So what they would do
they proved it.
Well, what they would do on the TV show is they would just have a cop come in and arrest them and end the skit.
Oh, really?
All the time, yeah. Like the argument skit. Have you ever seen that one? Uh-uh. I came for an argument. No, you didn't. You came for an argument. You know, and once it gets to a certain point, there'll be like an inspector or a cop who'll just come in. All right, I've had enough of this, and arrest them. So that's what they did for the Holy Grail. I don't know if they had an actual ending in mind, or this was just their humor to say, we're going to end this film the same way we end a lot of our skits and just end it with the cops coming in and arresting everybody.
Well, that would make sense then. That makes a lot more sense.
So,
I
find it hilarious because I know how many of their skits they end that way. And then they had the balls to make a full length feature film and end it with the cop arresting it.
Well, even the through line of the cops, you know, doing the full blown interview. I mean, that was an actual through line.
Yeah.
So it was premeditated through the whole film. And I think that shows the sign of talent is when you've got things that are, I guess the word that they use is meta. Mm-hmm. And I think they were thinking outside the box, and knowing that that's their history, that makes it funnier to me. But I didn't know that history until just now.
Well, I think that a lot of people might not. And I think that could be what rubs some people wrong about this film. Mm-hmm. Is that they're like, that's the ending. That's the best they could come up with. And no, they could come up with a great ending,
yes.
But that's what they wanted. Because, you know, Life of Brian, I know you don't like it, but that's a great ending where he's being crucified. And one of his crucifixes, I don't know what those are called, sings to him, always look on the bright side of life. You know?
Yeah. The reason I don't like that is sacrilegious. I know it borders on, you know, it's not supposed to really touch on Jesus's life, but I struggle with that. So that's my personal.
They were born on the same night.
Yeah. So that's my reasoning behind it. But as far as the Python troupe doing their thing, I've never really caught their show. I'd like to, and I actually have a couple episodes somewhere in my house, but I've never sat down and watched their show per se. So the most I've ever really seen is portions of Life of Brian and all of Holy Grail multiple times. So that's pretty much it, other than other movies that they are just regular actors in.
Let me tell you something. I studied Latin for 3 years, and I can tell you that Latin scene in the Life of Brian is how students feel. Like there's somebody over them threatening to kill them if they don't conjugate those verbs correctly.
Yeah.
Gets me every time.
The lack of a budget on this, which again, like I said, the budget was under 300, it's under 250,000 pounds, which was already super cheap, even for the 70s. That was ridiculously cheap. And it looks like it, but it's funny. I mean, it's like the, if you look at the Strange Brew that Bob and Doug McKenzie did from Second City, that they had a bigger, way bigger budget, but it felt like the same type of film. They're just meant to be farce and nothing more. It's just funny. They pull things out of their arses left and right, and that just becomes a running joke. And I loved how they improvised so much through this film. You could tell that there were lines that were not in the script, that they were just throwing out there just because that was the situation that they were in, and they just printed. So who was the director of this? Which one of them directed?
Both Terrys.
Gilliam. The two Terrys?
Yeah. Okay. They kind of co-directed.
Okay. But the writing was all six, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you could tell when they're improvising a bit. There's the scene where they are talking to, what was it?
About the witch?
About the witch. Where mm-hmm. John Cleese is changing his timing, where he pauses and mm-hmm. He's like, a witch? And you could see Eric Idle in the background. He has to bite that stick to keep himself from laughing out loud, and they kept it in the film. So you could tell that they were just trying to fuck around with each other.
Exactly. And I think that was part of it too, is that they were so comfortable with one another on the screen, especially when you're looking at the same characters. I mean, you're looking at the same six troop members in so many different scenes. I mean, they're in scene 24. They use the same old guy, you know, in scene, whatever, 45 or whenever he shows up on the bridge, and they're calling it scene 24. And I mean, it's just the cleverness that they used in creating this film. And I think that was why it is so beloved, is that this was genuinely a funny group of men that got together on the British countryside with a tiny sliver of a budget, had an extra week free, and just went, let's make a film about King Arthur. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Grab some coconuts. We're off and running.
Right.
So,
and for something so absurd and silly, it's pretty intelligent comedy as far as I'm concerned.
Totally agreed. I because of the age of it, I wonder if they didn't hear that they were trying that Hollywood or where the UK's the BBC were thinking about adapting some sort of a King Arthur legend, and they just went, "Hey, what a great idea! Let's make a Python film." So I because they could just throw it together with this crew. I mean, this very, very talented crew, they could throw it together over a weekend of drinking and they can and go out and have it done within the week.
Graham would have stretched that weekend out to a week.
like I said, the drinking probably never stopped on set, but
it was a large part of their budget.
Right. 200,000 pounds was to the alcohol.
Yep.
And the 25,000 was for the bunny.
All right, let's go around the table. I think we talked this one out. After all said and done, on a scale of 1 to 5, do you consider this film a bad one, or do you give it a high five?
Oh, this is a 4.5. As far as comedy, it misses obviously in certain scenes, but that's the whole point. It's not meant to be a masterpiece of literature or you know, something like Gone with the Wind or anything that's going to be a lasting legacy. This was meant to be a Python funny film, and I think this is, in my opinion, I'm limited on my Python history, but this to me is the best Python I've ever seen, and especially compared to Life of Brian. And I just think that they were great. Totally worth it. Very much just know going in what it is.
Well, for me, it's 5 stars. Mm-hmm. It's in my top 100. I would say it's probably my top 30. It's not as high as Life of Brian for sure. But, you know, my major in college was humanities, so I studied a lot of Greek and Roman history. You know, it just rings a bell. There's a lot of absurdity that is based in truth in that one as well. The stoning with women in that one, but that's a different review. This is way better than Meaning of Life. If you have not seen that one, Bobby, skip it.
Honestly, I think I started that one and turned it off.
Yeah, it's a disappointment, especially after these two. If you're a Monty Python fan, I would say watch it just to have watched it, but it's really not great. But this one's fantastic. One of my favorite movies from the 70s. Mm. And it holds up very well to this day. A little bit of dated sections in
yes.
it.
Yeah.
But, you know, all comedy is going to get a little dated as times change and temperaments change and things such as that.
Well, and you have to be in the right mood for it, to be honest. This isn't a comedy like a Jim Carrey comedy. This isn't one of those where you just sit down and it's going to be Dumb and Dumber. This actually, you have to think through it, but it's really good if you drink. I'm sure it would be even funnier if you've had a few beers in you and just start chuckling like the college kids that we were when I first saw it. And you just kind of have your buddies over and have a good laugh, and And at the end of the film, you feel happier at the end of the film, even if the end of the film is not what you're expecting.
You know, this is the 70s. There might have been some acid or LSD involved too.
Well, I think that was definitely the end of the opening credits. Some acid was involved.
All the flashing green and reds and blacks. And
not a good thing for narcoleptics. Or what is it? Epileptics.
Yeah, there need to be a warning for that one.
That definitely. It did kind of, whoa, that came out of nowhere.
All right, well, that's it for our review of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Please let us know what you think of the film in the comments section. And for our listeners over on moviehousememories.com, please rate it from 1 to 5 stars on that page as well. If you enjoyed today's review, why the fuck wouldn't you? Right, Bobby?
Or would you?
Or would you, yeah. Please don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, the MHM Podcast Network, where we have many, many more film reviews from yesterday, today, and beyond.
And tomorrow.
Before they've even made it. Until next time, I'm Chris.
I'm Bobby.
And this concession stand is now closed. This podcast is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The theme song for Movie House Concessions, Rock On Brudda, is brought to you by Marwan Nimra at netentine.com under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Movie House Concessions, the MHM Podcast Network, and Fuzzy Bunny Slippers Entertainment LLC, unless otherwise noted.